me, Alexander represents a continuity into the modern life with what he brought and what he preserved for us. And because, I mean, by conquering and Persia and Egypt and all these areas, he then, after his death, Hellenism came through and it became like a dominant feature of the landscape. And with Hellenism also, what you had is the ideas of the philosophers before, you know, and that to me is what sort of attracted me to Alexander in the first place. So that's the reason why I sort of, you know, why I'm quite enthusiastic about Alexander and what he did and why he did things, and so on.
Now, your topic in the Classics Conference is pretty much in the things that he believed in, and you quote, you know, the gods of Greece, the gods of Egypt, the monotheism, the Zoroastrian monotheism that he'll have experienced in Persia, perhaps also the philosophies when he finally made it into India. So there you've got him straddling the whole world like a colossus, but his tutor was Aristotle, and that must have had a massive influence on him.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's my theory of it. I mean, one of the big enigmas and one of the big mysteries about Alexander is about the reasons for his extraordinary ability to succeed in pretty much everything that he attempted. I mean, there's no other person in history that created so many firsts or that matched or improved on all previous historical marvels or feats. And obviously, one of the reasons many historians, and included, believe one of the reasons for his extraordinary success is how he dealt with religion. Because, I mean, how did he reconcile all these different religions and all these different belief systems in the territories that he now ruled? And essentially, you know, what was therefore his religion? How could he have done this?
My thought, of course, is that as a politically pragmatic ruler, he was prepared not only not to interfere, but he would take part in what he felt like taking part in. Of course, every now and again, they'd deify him. So every now and again, he'd turn into a god himself.
Well, therein lies the problem. Therein lies the problem, because what we have is, you have to keep in mind that he had several titles. He had several responsibilities. I mean, first of all, and primarily, he was the warrior king of the kingdom of Macedon. And because of that, he was also the head priest. So that means that he was responsible for performing the rituals the correct way and for the local gods. However, at the same time as that, he was also the hegemon of the Hellenic League, that is the leader of an alliance of mainly Greek states for the purpose of revenging the Persian invasion of Greece earlier. But the Greeks had anthropomorphic gods, you know, so, you know, gods in human form, you know, beings living in Mount Olympus just around the corner. And then on top of all this, he was also a pharaoh of Egypt. Now, the Egyptians worship therianthropic gods, that is, half man and half human. And as such, he had to be a god. I mean, he was pronounced Horus as such, you know, which is the standard for a pharaoh ever since the Fifth Dynasty. And when a pharaoh dies, then he becomes Osiris, so he is essentially god. And then the last one, too, he was also Lord of Asia, or the by the Persian title, King of Kings, which means that he was not a god, but he was a representative of God. So what you have here is four very much different belief systems. And like you said earlier, on top of all this, he was actually educated by Aristotle.
Yeah, it's a long way from Queen Elizabeth II of England being also head of the Church of England to being Alexander the Great and you know, high priest of the Hellenic League. You wonder how he found time to go out and, you know, have battles and things.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, the main thing is what many historians have a problem with here is how did he reconcile all these different belief systems and, you know, all these different religions? Because essentially, I mean, that even happens in modern system. Each different religions, they disrespect, they assault each other in one way or the other. And many modern historians, in particular A.D. Bosworth, who sadly just passed away last month, he argued for the theory that Alexander actually believed that he was a god, and that's how he done it. I don't subscribe to that theory. And I heard a quick, brief discussion with this with Bosworth 2 years ago in Sydney when he heard me deliver a paper on Heraclitus and the Macedonian ruling house. But that is a prevalent theory about Alexander, is that he believed that he was a god.
One of the other challenges, of course, or rather one of the other aspects of this, is that we may turn on the TV and we're looking at the news from right around the world within seconds. But in Alexander's day, contact between his home ground in Macedon in Greece, in the northern part of Greece, the heartland of Persia or wherever, a lot of people, unless they were really way up on the sort of the information ladder, wouldn't have actually known about Alexander's position in these various countries. So a certain amount of stuff he could easily get away with because nobody knew he was doing it.
Oh, definitely. I mean, at the same time, the Persian system which apparently the American postal system based itself on having horses every 30 kilometers and so on, were reasonably efficient. I mean, it wasn't really replicated for a very, very long time afterwards. But yes, certainly the communication, back and forth would have been, a great challenge.
But if we look at the Aristotelian aspect of it, is there something in Aristotelian philosophy that you feel would have made it easy or perhaps even inevitable for Alexander to manage this transition?
I personally believe so. I mean, Aristotle, of course, did so much writing in so many different fields. It is just an enigma in himself. But in politics, in one of his main books, he has there a quote which is quite revealing. If I may quote, he says, Aristotle says, "A successful ruler must show devotion to religion because people are less fearful of those who pay regards to the gods." And that's the end of the quote. And in my opinion, wherever Alexander went, he respected all belief systems. He adhered to all the traditions that they had in place. He built temples for Persian Baal. He built temples for Osiris, I think it was, for Egyptian Isis, and for the Greek gods. Everywhere he went, he respected traditions where they were locally. He didn't insult any of them. In contrast to Cambyses, who conquered Egypt for the Persians, he had great difficulty in reconciling the Egyptian population because he just couldn't believe that their religion was so different.
And when you come here to Adelaide to talk about this, how are you going to set out your argument? There'll be a great many people here who know their Aristotle, others who want to know a lot more about Alexander. And you've found one of those numinous aspects of his life, something that goes beyond just his record of battles and his travels into India. How do you start explaining this to perhaps a not so philosophically literate?
The basis of the theory that Alexander thought he was a god centers around three events, three main events. One of those events is that when he went to visit the oracle, the Egyptian oracle at Siwa, that the priest pronounced him a god. That's one of the events. The second event is that after Alexander returned from India, he supposedly had a really extravagant party where he emulated the god Dionysus. And the third one is the event that he announced at the Greek Olympics, that he requested the granting of divine honors for himself from the Greeks. The problem with these three items, which the divinity theory is based on, is that the likelihood that any of these three events took place is reasonably improbable. I mean, there's not a single eyewitness from the time, and there's lots of eyewitness from Alexander's time, as well as there's no primary documents that can verify with certainty that any of these events actually happened. So that would be my main argument.
And if they didn't happen, it was obviously to somebody's advantage, Alexander's perhaps or not, to tell people that they did happen. Why do you think that might be?
Well, therein lies the problem, because one of the great difficulties we have with Alexander is that within the history of Alexander, there's essentially four types of sources. The main source, of course, is eyewitness accounts, which is what we'll call the primary source. And there was lots and lots of eyewitness accounts. The second type is the secondary source. So eyewitness accounts, which haven't survived to these days, are preserved in secondary sources, which belongs to people like Plutarch, who read the primary sources and then wrote the analysis after having read them. Then, of course, there's tertiary sources, which read secondary sources and then produce their analysis. However, to use an anachronistic term, there's people like Hollywood historians who use artistic freedom to tell a story loosely based on the truth. And in Alexander's time, there was particularly a writer who was called Clitarchus, son of Dion. Now, he published a book very soon. He was one of the first to publish a book very soon after Alexander's death. But Clitarchus was not an eyewitness, and he did not accompany Alexander. But what he was the son of a real historian who actually wrote a history of Persia and who had spent time in the Persian court. And on top of this, Clitarchus was a good writer and he wrote a really good story, but he didn't worry so much about the truth. And there's ancient writers like Cicero and a range of them who, you know, call him like windbag and so on, how he mistold the truth. So therein we have one. It's like watching a Hollywood movie as well as reading, you know, eyewitness accounts. They do not reconcile.
But obviously Clitarchus in his day must have been very popular. As you're saying, Hollywood history, it's colourful, it's well told.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah, he's definitely popular. There's no doubt about that. But if you look at, say, for example, the pronunciation by the Egyptian priest at the Oracle of Siwa, both Plutarch and Arrian, who, of course, is only uses prior eyewitness accounts, they dispute that happened. They say that, yes, he did go and see the priest, but they spoke in private. Then we have about the extravagant party of the god Dionysus. I mean, Arrian writes about this. I mean, I've got a quote here for him, if I may. There's a quote that he writes. So supposedly, after Alexander has come back from India, he has this absolutely magnificent, amazing, wonderfully weird, you know, party emulating the god Dionysus. And Arrian, he writes, quote, he says, there's no mention of this party in either Ptolemy, son of Logos, or in Aristobulus, or indeed in any other writer whom one might consider to give reliable evidence. In any case, there's a story, I do not believe it, and that's all I propose to say. And that's the end quote. So what you have here, you have people like Plutarch and Arrian who have read all of the eyewitness accounts, and this is their analysis and their last word. And you know, I do tend to take a little bit of weight on that one.
Now, we do know that after an amazing and astonishing career, Alexander died very young.
Yes.
His body ended up in Alexandria, but has since disappeared. Do we have you found modern archaeological expeditions, information that perhaps we can now piece together from other sources to add more weight to aspects of Alexander's life? Perhaps this tomb they're excavating in Greece is where his body ended up. We don't know, but do you know of anything that may support aspects of his story that wasn't known to people like Plutarch and Aristobulus?
Well, I mean, the tomb of Alexander was known to be Alexandria for quite some time. I mean, it was visited by all the Roman emperors, you know, Caesar, as well as several other ones who borrowed his armor and so on. So he was certainly in Alexandria for a long period of time. What ended up with it and where it happened afterwards is a big mystery, because there's a big gap. That, you know, 1,000 years worth of a gap in history in that area, so we don't know what happened since, but it certainly was. You have to remember too that what you had, Aristotle, he was the pinnacle of an intellectual revolution that started some 250 years earlier, where they collectively, at least, you know, the intellectual elite, they discarded gods and instead started to look for rational explanations for natural events. which of course started with the first philosopher, Thales, who predicted a solar eclipse, according to Herodotus, in the middle of the battle between the Medians and Leeds, Lydians and the Medes. But that was the beginning of an investigation to find out that there's arbitrary events have rational explanations. So what you had here is a society with the great library of Alexandria that was reasonably literate and had a very interesting tradition of preserving information and knowledge. That all lasted, you know, pretty much until the beginning of the Dark Ages.
And where for you now, in terms of your analysis of Alexander and his life, what's the next step?
As with history, what you have to do, I guess, is you have to come up with a theory, and then you show it to other historians and other people, and they look at the evidence that you present, and if they agree, then they'll say so, and if they don't, then they present another theory. So with this particular one, there has been a few people who were disagreeing with the theory that Alexander thought that he was God, which is particularly relevant, you know, watching Hollywood movies, you know, Oliver Stone's movie and the one in the 50s as well. So I'd like to put some more effort into that Alexander was actually more a child of Aristotle and the intellectual revolution rather than actually believing himself a god. So I would like to push a bit more on that theory and have other people, you know, have a look at, you know, what I propose and see what they think about that.
And as long as you don't come to blows in the forecourt of the University of Adelaide during the conference, I guess everything's going to be fine and dandy.
Exactly. I don't think that will happen. I mean, usually where your theories are presented and you listen to, and if there's a hole in it, it gets exposed, even if it takes many years to do it. So this is how history gets known in the end. You know, you have to propose one theory and then, you know, challenge it and so on, which is, you know, again, you know, how Aristotle would have liked us to investigate and find out the truth.